KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. It's a double-wide trailer off the Birchwood exit on the outskirts of Anchorage, Alaska. Not exactly a Las Vegas-style casino, but since the Acluna Tribe's new gaming hall opened in January, there are often long lines of people waiting to get in. That could change if the state is successful in its bid to shut down the gambling operation. On Wednesday, the Alaska Attorney General asked a federal court in Washington, D.C. to issue a preliminary injunction against it. This follows a lawsuit the state filed in February after the Interior Department approved the project in the final days of the Biden administration. The Chenon Gaming Hall sits on a native allotment near the Birchwood Airport. The Interior Department under Biden said the Acluna Tribe has sovereignty over the land, just as tribes in the lower 48 have over reservations where gaming is allowed. But the state is fighting that decision based on previous court cases that gave the state jurisdiction over native allotments. Aaron Leggett, president of the Acluna Tribe, called the latest court filing disheartening, a sign that Governor Mike Dunleavy is escalating his attack on tribal sovereignty. In a statement, he touted the success of the casino and its potential to bring jobs and economic opportunity to the region. The gaming hall is in a temporary building with fewer than 100 electronic bingo games. The tribe plans to expand to a larger facility with more machines and restaurants. Minnesota's unemployment rate is low, but the state still faces a skilled labor shortage. A regional college hopes to be a solution as it looks to break ground on a new training center for in-demand jobs. Data shows Minnesota has a job vacancy rate of more than 5%. That's above the desired goal of around 4%, with the older population leaving the workforce. At White Earth Tribal and Community College, school president Anna Shepherd says not having a big enough talent pool for certain job types is a problem in her part of the state.
You know, we've had to wait for electricians to come in, just do work here, just because there's not money in this area.
The school is planning a trades building on campus to develop the next generation of plumbers, electricians, and other skilled workers. It could also benefit White Earth's plan to expand its renewable energy programming for students. The project's cost is $15 million. Supporters hope the state will chip in, but a tighter spending mood in the legislature, along with the impact of federal cuts, could make that difficult. White Earth Student Senate President Deidre Berg sees this planned building as a way to keep Indigenous students post-graduation in surrounding communities that struggle with limited wages and a lack of resources.
We are a food desert area, and so that's like a really big issue here. We'd like to be able to offer our people, our students, the tools to get their education here and hopefully stay close to home and build our community up.
The organization Fresh Energy says training students for projects like solar power development can help local economies get stronger. Campus officials say they've already secured land for the trades building and the architectural renderings are complete. If state aid is slow, White Earth will try to line up grants and other support. Training could begin as early as fall of 2027. An India mascot bill has passed the Illinois House of Representatives. WIFR reports the legislation prohibits K-12 schools in the state from using a Native American name, logo, or mascot. It passed by a vote of 71-40. If signed into law, schools will have until 2026 to make changes. The bill now heads to the Senate. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
I think it's pretty apparent that the industry's facing a lot of challenges. I think it's one of the most challenging times that I can recall.
Uncertainty clouds the largest commercial fishery in the nation. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 11th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a pair of Anchorage teens encourage their peers to give back to the community.
If they feel engaged with their community, maybe they go to college out of state, maybe they get a bit of working experience out of state, but I believe that they'll come back to Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. We're glad to have you tuning in, and we'd love to welcome you as a member. Make a donation to this station and be a part of the public media family. Thank you.
It's been a busy week in the state legislature. An education funding boost passed the House and Senate today and is now headed for the governor, who has promised to veto it. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone is here in Anchorage with me, but even though he's been outside Juneau, he's been glued to Gavel, Alaska, and is here to break it all down for us. Eric, weren't the House and Senate working with the governor on a compromise education bill? What happened?
Well, you know, Casey, life comes at you fast. A lot has changed here in the last couple of days. So the House passed a bill a while ago that would boost the so-called base student allocation by $1,000. People on all sides of the political spectrum seem to agree that education funding needs a boost, though the amount is a big subject of debate. But it's not an exaggeration to say that promises to boost education funding are a big reason a lot of legislators won their races last year. It was maybe the top issue in a campaign. Governor Mike Dunleavy, though, has consistently called for funding increases to be tied to specific policy changes that he says will improve test scores. So the bill the House passed has had a lot of things that the governor liked. Then it went to the Senate. The Senate Education Committee threw some more changes into it, not all of which the governor liked. And then on Thursday, the Senate Finance Committee crumpled all of that up, threw it in the trash. That stripped out everything except for the $1,000 funding boost. The committee co-chair, Bethel Democratic Senator Lyman Hoffman, said basically, you know, we're going to figure out how much support this $1,000 boost has by itself. How much support in the House, how much support in the Senate, and in the governor's office. And today we have something of an answer. 11 out of the 20 senators voted for it. That's all of the bipartisan majority senators minus the three co-chairs of the Senate Finance Committee. Hoffman, who handles the state operating budget, has said again and again that a $1,000 boost is probably more than the state can afford given low oil prices this year. And just this afternoon, the House voted to concur with those changes. The vote was 21-16 with three minority Republicans absent. And we also know what the governor thinks of it now. So basically, as soon as the Senate Finance Committee rolled out that naked funding boost bill, Dunleavy came out and said it was a, quote, joke. He said he would veto it immediately after it passed the House and Senate. He did not change his tune.
Okay. Well, what's going on here? I mean, why are they pushing forward a bill that the governor has called a joke and promised to immediately veto?
Yeah, it's a good question. I am going to veer a little bit into speculation here. In the news business, we call it analysis. This whole thing strikes me as an effort to make a point.
What is that point?
So I think lawmakers are making a few different points. Senators and House members who voted to support the bill say schools desperately need money, and the struggling school system is an existential threat to the state's future. As far as why they voted for a bill that will almost definitely be vetoed, it seems like they might be playing hardball with the governor. Maybe they want Dunleavy to get some bad headlines for vetoing the bill. Maybe they're just communicating that they're frustrated that the governor isn't engaging with them in negotiating something workable. Minority Republicans who oppose the bill say that's exactly what's going on. Representative Delaina Johnson from Palmer called it, and I quote, a calculated maneuver that will have the effect of doing nothing. And I think the Senate Finance co-chairs who voted against their own bill are making a point that, you know, there's not enough support in the building to override the governor, and that without extra money coming in from new taxes on things like oil and corporate income, The state probably can't afford it. That's essentially what Hoffman, the head Senate budgeter, said on the floor.
Well, speaking of what the state can afford, tell us about what's going on with the budget. You wrote this week that the budget bill has a massive $3,800 permanent fund dividend in it, but you say it's basically a mirage. What's going on there?
So here's how things usually work. Usually in early to mid-April, the House finishes up the majority of its work on the state operating budget, and that's the budget for the state's day-to-day business. But the House Finance Committee, they got stuck on the PFD. Two Democrats from rural districts, where the PFD is a big part of residents' disposable income, supported large PFDs in committee votes, and that left the majority without enough votes to take the governor's $3,800 PFD out of the budget. Until today, actually just a few minutes ago, the House voted to cut the PFD to roughly $1,400. That's a figure that Senate leaders have supported. Meanwhile, Republicans in the House are crying foul. They say they were assured that the PFD amendment would not be up for debate today. Again, they have three members out of town. The House Speaker disputed, you know, that assurance was made on the floor. But in any case, you know, it still leaves a big deficit, somewhere in the hundreds of millions of dollars in this budget. And how they'll address that is anybody's guess. There will be some more budget amendments on Monday, so we'll have to stay tuned to Gavel, Alaska to see what's next.
All right. That was Alaska Public Media's Capitol reporter Eric Stone here in Anchorage with us. We're thankful for that, and thank you for the report.
So glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Pollock A season is wrapping up in the Bering Sea with solid returns across the board. Weather interruptions caused some hiccups along the way, nothing outside the norm for the region. But there are a few new factors worrying the industry, including cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and expanded tariffs on seafood. KUCB's Andy Lusk has the story.
Pollock keeps the lights on in Unalaska, oftentimes known by the name of its international port, Dutch Harbor. That's the country's largest fishing port by volume. Alaska pollock is also the largest commercial fishery in the U.S. by volume. This year's total allowable catch for the Bering Sea pollock fishery is slightly higher than it was last year. That means fishermen can collectively harvest just under 1.5 million metric tons of pollock before calling it quits and heading back to shore. Frank Kelty is a former mayor of Unalaska and the city's current fisheries advisor. He spent half a century in town and knows its biggest revenue source well.
Overall, fishing's been very strong for the whole season. And that's what we saw in the B season, and that's what we saw last season, too. So it's been very, overall, very steady.
Pollock A season typically runs from mid-January to the end of April, with a separate B season from June to October. Kelty says right now, fish are coming in at medium sizes.
They won't be the real monster fillets, but they'll still be good product.
But Kelty has his eye on a few developments at the national level that could cause industry-wide disruptions. He says competition with Russian seafood products is still top of mind, but there are new ones too, like expanded tariffs recently announced by the Trump administration and cuts to federal regulatory agencies. That includes the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. The agency oversees the sprawling pollock fishery.
I'm very concerned on what's going on with NOAA. It's really could be dangerous to us in the Bering Sea.
Some NOAA employees who were fired in February have since been reinstated, but are on non-duty status, which means they haven't actually returned to work. Kelty says he's concerned about how that could affect future surveys in the region. He cites issues with getting the snow crab fishery open in 2020 when there was no survey due to the pandemic.
Industry couldn't come up with a way to do it themselves with NOAA personnel because it was COVID, so none of the NOAA people were working. We had no survey, so we didn't have a season. So the next year, when we did have a season, there was no crab, and we didn't have the information ahead of time.
Unisi is a Japanese-owned seafood processing company with a plant in Dutch Harbor. Tom Enlow is the company's CEO. He shares similar concerns.
I think it's pretty apparent that the industry's facing a lot of challenges. I think it's one of the most challenging times that I can recall the industry as a whole.
Concerns over tariffs in particular are popping up across the seafood industry. This comes as the state's industry is coming off a tough couple of years of low prices and challenging market conditions. In response, two seafood trade groups that represent part of the Bering Sea pollock fleet penned their concerns to the federal government in an open letter last month. The At-Sea Processors Association and the Pacific Seafood Processors Association argue new tariffs imposed by the U.S. could prompt even further strain on Alaska seafood exports. Enlow similarly calls tariffs an obstacle for the industry.
They prohibit, you know, us continuing to do business with our trade partners. The timing of all of it, this is really difficult for us to take. And so we hope that, you know, some things will get excluded or relaxed, seafood being one of them.
Nevertheless, in the short term, Enlow considers this a season to be a success. He says prices are improving over last year's for surimi in particular. That's a pollock product often used as a crab substitute. He expects to know more about where markets stand after the Seafood Expo Global Conference, which takes place next month in Barcelona, Spain. In Unalaska, I'm Andy Lusk.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a gas station mini-mart in Bethel redefines the boundaries of Southern soul food.
You know, I got the barbecue rib plate, you know, eating a little heavy today. This is a cheap day. Some people from work said they liking it, so I was like, hey, let me go ahead and come on down and come try it.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Ensure the vitality of public radio by including it in your estate planning. Together, we build a sustainable future for quality media. Thank you.
An Anchorage police officer's home was searched this week by fellow officers and the FBI as police seek a missing man last seen nearby. Police said Wednesday that they had searched an Eagle River home on Mercy Drive. The Anchorage Daily News reported that the home was owned by Officer Christopher Sternhagen. Police have also been searching for 40-year-old Tony Mac Kronos, who was last seen on March 6th at a home about a block away. Asked about this week's search, police said only that it was, quote, part of an ongoing investigation. An FBI statement said agents had responded to a law enforcement request. Police are asking anyone with information on Mac Kronos' whereabouts to call them at 311 or submit an anonymous tip online at Anchorage Crime Stoppers. Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance says her administration is chipping away at one of her keystone goals, building 10,000 homes in 10 years. The initiative comes as housing prices have soared in Anchorage, fewer homes are available, and homelessness has become a crisis for the city. At a press conference at City Hall on Thursday, LaFrance admitted she has an ambitious goal.
10,000 homes in 10 years is a bold strategy to bring more housing to Anchorage. We won't fix a housing crisis like ours through simply one single action. We need to be committed to a series of actions that make it cheaper and easier to build or renovate.
LaFrance highlighted recent efforts to improve the housing situation in Anchorage, like the temporary lifting of design standards on certain homes and expediting the permitting process for new construction. Assemblymember Anna Brawley has introduced an ordinance that would create a temporary tax reprieve for new multifamily home construction. Brawley says it would reduce the cost of building homes and allow the city to invest in new construction.
Essentially, the idea, again, is to make it more financially feasible by temporarily giving up some of that tax revenue with the idea that eventually that property gets fully on the tax rolls.
Brawley's ordinance is scheduled to have a public hearing next Wednesday with a vote by the Assembly set for April 22nd. Two Anchorage teens are trying to encourage more young people to get involved with philanthropy, giving their time and money to benefit society as a whole. Youth Philanthropists Alaska, or YPA, aims to teach kids aged 12 to 17 the power of investing in local charities. Alaska Public Media's Ava White spoke with 8th grader Liam Cuddy and 9th grader Adam Kaufman, who started the group. They had their first meeting last week and raised more than $2,000 for Covenant House Alaska. Cuddy says he's excited by the group's early success.
We got, I think, 72 kids at our first meeting, and they each got a bunch of, like, one-sentence descriptions of nonprofits, so they could just see their first impressions of the nonprofits, which nonprofits supported causes that they really care about, if it's homelessness, helping people with disabilities. And then we took two of the top two nonprofits who got the most responses, and also one wildcard nonprofit. And then those three presented at the first meeting. So each kid gives $10, each of the three nonprofits presents, and then they vote on which nonprofit to give the grand prize pool to. So I think for our first meeting, it was $2,160. And so we give the grand prize pool to the nonprofit with the most votes. So the nonprofits for our first meeting were Covenant House Alaska, the eventual winner, Special Olympics Alaska, and the August Fund. We had some corporate sponsors say, hey, we'd love to match you guys. And so that jumped it.
Adam, are there any particular issues or causes that you're especially passionate about supporting?
So my brother had colitis, and he spent a lot of his time supporting the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation of America. And I'm just pretty into that cause because growing up, I would have bake sales and I would sell lemonade on the side of the road trying to raise money for that cause because it was close to my heart. You know, my brother had that disease.
So do you feel like it was instilled in you from a young age?
I think so, yeah. And I found how important that was to me, and I wanted to help do that for other kids.
Liam, philanthropy is obviously important for so many reasons, but why is it important for young people specifically to get into philanthropy, do you think?
I think the truth is Alaska is just facing a population loss right now. And so I think we really need a set of young kids who are like, man, this community has done so much for me. I probably won't be able to give that back now as a, 15-year-old, but I can at least start. And it really gets them engaged with their community. And I strongly believe that if they feel engaged with their community, maybe they go to college out of state. Maybe they get a bit of working experience out of state. But I believe that they'll come back to Alaska because they really feel connected to the community.
Also, another reason is, philanthropy is so important in young people because this is kind of the most developmental part of our life. And if we grow up giving philanthropy, we'll see the importance of it, and then we'll go and do it for our whole life. But what's really overlooked is that, yeah, it's for philanthropy. Yeah, we're making an impact in these nonprofits, but we're also bringing all the kids together and teaching them about philanthropy. And if they have a fun first interaction with philanthropy, that'll inspire more kids to do it, and they grow older and they do it, then they teach their children to do it, and it's just generations of philanthropy are inspired by even what could be seen as a small event here.
Liam, has this experience changed how you view your community or even the state?
I think it's even viewed how I change the nation or how I view the nation as a whole, because anyone who is looking at the tensions in our society can see that we just have a lot of differences right now, and that there are a lot of people who very much disagree with each other. But it made me have more hope for the future, because before I was thinking, man, can these differences ever even be reconciled? And then I was thinking, oh my gosh, they actually can, because we can have this thing of bringing good to the community, and that can bring everyone together, and that can kind of start working through the differences. And so that really changed how I viewed Anchorage, this state, the national, even just the world. And I think this is something that isn't even recognized as much from adults, but youth care. They really care about their communities. And when given a chance to show it, they really come up and they show up for their community, and they really want to be an engaged and active part of their community.
That was Liam Cuddy and Adam Kaufman talking to Alaska Public Media's Ava White. Cuddy and Kaufman are the founders of Youth Philanthropists Alaska. The group's next meeting will be in October.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University offers new and transfer students a wide range of scholarships, grants, and other financial assistance. Apply for admission to be considered automatically for most scholarships, and complete your financial aid application by priority deadlines to receive optimal consideration. Financial aid counselors are available to assist. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
Matanuska-Susitna Borough property owners can expect slightly higher tax bills under a proposed budget that goes before the Borough Assembly this month. The Matsu Sentinel reports the proposal would increase the average borough property tax bill by $115 compared to last year. The proposed budget covers borough administrative expenses and capital projects, including voter-approved road and school construction, $1 million for public transportation, landfill upgrades, and a new $2.5 million barge ramp at Port McKenzie. It proposes an area-wide rate of 8.612 mils, or $861.20 per $100,000 of assessed property value. The average assessed value of a single-family home in the borough for 2025 is $388,091, a 5% increase over last year. The proposed mill rate is a slight decrease from last year's area-wide rate, but because assessed property values have increased year over year, a lower mill rate does not necessarily mean a lower tax bill. Wednesday's budget presentation did not include details on total proposed spending for the upcoming fiscal year, which begins July 1st. That information is still being developed and will be delivered to the Assembly at a meeting scheduled for Tuesday. Well, microplastics appear to be ubiquitous in spotted seals harvested in Alaska's most remote waters. That's according to the lead author of a paper published last month in a peer-reviewed journal. Biologist Alex Sletten led the work.
It blew my mind how when you think about the Arctic, you think about this pristine environment that hasn't really been touched or affected by anthropogenic stress. But in reality, like, there's so much microplastics out there.
The findings are part of a growing body of work showing that even in far-flung parts of the Arctic, plastic pollution is deeply embedded in the ecosystem and in the animals people rely on. Sletten analyzed the stomachs of 34 spotted seals harvested in the Bering and Chukchi Seas. All but one had microplastics. Those are tiny synthetic particles less than 5 millimeters in size, often shed from synthetic clothing, fishing gear, or broken down consumer plastics. Her research, published in the Marine Pollution Bulletin, is the first study to document microplastic ingestion in marine mammals from these regions, and it suggests the problem has been around for at least a decade. The seals were harvested in 2012 and 2020, and contamination levels did not change much between those years. Sletten's team used special enzymes to break down the prey found in the seals' stomachs and then isolated the plastic particles. Sletten says the results did not vary between the seals' ages, location, or harvest year, which she says shows how pervasive microplastics are. Sletten says the implications are significant. Spotted seals feed largely on animals that live along the sea floor, as well as on fish species that are pretty high up the food chain. Both types of prey contain relatively high levels of microplastics. Her team found the levels in the seals were even higher, which suggests the plastics may be bioaccumulating through the food web.
What we found was that seals that were eating primarily prey from higher up the food chain had a tendency to have a higher microplastic abundance within their stomach.
There are big implications for people, too. These seals were harvested in Gambell and Shishmaref, where communities rely on marine mammals for subsistence. The health impacts of this exposure are still being studied, but previous research has linked microplastics to endocrine disruption, gut microbiome changes, and lipid metabolism issues, a concern for animals that rely on thick blubber to survive Arctic temperatures. At lunchtime, the rural hub community of Bethel buzzes with activity as workers hit the highway to fuel up for the second half of the day. As KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, for those who don't have time to sit down to a meal, one gas station and mini-mart is redefining what it means to grab a quick bite.
If you grew up in America, then you've probably already seen enough JoJo potatoes, chicken tenders, and mozzarella sticks to last a lifetime. But step into Quick Foods in Bethel and it quickly becomes clear the history of the gas station hot case is still being written.
We do orange chicken, crab rangoon, mac and cheese bites, beef lasagna, chicken and pork lumpia.
Manager Lenny Allred reads off the handwritten labels attached to the edge of a sprawling plexiglass enclosure.
Seafood pasta, shepherd's pie, barbecue wings, prime rib, steak and potatoes, sweet chili wings, and many more items. They're not all of them here.
All of the roughly 50 dishes have at one point graced the hot case at the popular convenience mart, locally known as Q2. Many disappear in a matter of minutes during lunch rushes like today's.
We try to get all the food out by 11 o'clock, and we try to do every day something different. Like today, we have some specials.
Today, Q2 is offering up Allred's own Cajun pasta, a guaranteed seller, alongside a new barbecue platter, and they're quickly bought up. One of the last goes to TSA worker D'Angelo Willis.
I got the barbecue rib plate, you know, eating a little heavy today. This is a cheap day. So some people from work said they liking it, so I was like, hey, let me go ahead and come on down and come try it.
The platter is the creation of Q2 employee Michael Hogue, a transplant to Bethel from the Mississippi Gulf Coast. He's also the man behind the newly introduced biscuits with reindeer sausage gravy, an immediate hit.
It's all about just reading what you see coming in, you know. I'm like, all right, well, people seem to like this kind of thing. So how about if I give them a little play on it from what I know from my Southern background? And it seemed to work very well.
Hogue says he started his day at 5 a.m. pumping out breakfast burritos and Belgian waffle platters for the morning rush. There was little time to spare before the second wave of customers.
For the lunch rush here, we have bacon cheeseburgers. We have bacon jalapeno burgers. We also have a nice turkey bacon ranch sandwich. And we are also doing some bratwurst.
Over his years working in the food industry, Hogue says he's seen similarly ambitious hot cases, but nothing quite on the level of Q2.
Yes, there are gas stations that try stuff like this, but they don't never put that much food in the window.
Hogue isn't the only Q2 employee bringing Southern flavors to Bethel. O'Neill Domino from New Orleans stands over a barrel-shaped deep fryer full of chicken wings.
Yes, sir. We're trying to bring a little bit of that Southern hospitality here to Bethel. They flats and legs. And when I tell you, it pack a big punch to be so small. It's just my special Southern ingredients.
Oh, secret?
That's a little secret.
Domino says he already has more than wings on his mind for Q2.
I'm going to try to get the breaded pork chops down here with a twist with it. So that's what I'm working on now.
Behind the register, Domino promotes the Louisiana wings to customers who scan the case. Queena Anderson, a recent arrival from Texas, hesitates, but then switches her chicken chunks out for the wings.
I got the food, but I don't know how it tastes yet. But I could try one. He say they good.
What? You got me still saying what?
Mm-hmm.
And get your ranch dipping. Your ranch go with it.
And see, you know they good when you don't have to dip them in anything.
Well, that's
so,
right. Somebody else told me that.
Yep, and they real good and flavorful and crunchy.
Domino is beaming at the affirmation. It's these types of interactions that the store's manager, Allred, says make Q2 stand out in Bethel.
We're very personable here. 80% of the customer, I know their names, and I think that's what makes difference for us to be busy and have people keep coming back.
By 1 p.m., Hogue's barbecue platters are like a distant memory. Allred's Cajun pasta is running low, and most of O'Neill's wings have taken flight. Tomorrow, the Q2 crew will do it all again, showing the world of quick eats what one hot case is capable of. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone, Chris Clint, Wesley Early, and Ava White in Anchorage, Andy Lusk and Theo Greenlee in Unalaska, and Evan Erickson in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. Planned Gifts as a bequest to your local station builds a legacy that is long-lasting. Thanks for considering this option. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
I got my toes in the water, in the sand. Not a worry in the world, a cold beer in my hand. Life is good today. Life is good today. Well, a plane touched down just about 3 o'clock, and the city's still on my mind. Bikinis and palm trees danced in my head. I was still in the baggage line. Concrete cars with their own prison bars, like this life I'm living in. But the plane brought me farther. I'm surrounded by water, and I'm not going back again. I got my toes in the water, in the sand. Not a worry in the world, a cold beer in my hand. Life is good today. Life is good today. Adios and vaya con Dios. Yeah, I'm leaving GA. And if it weren't for tequila and pretty señoritas, I'd have no reason to stay. Adios and vaya con Dios. Yeah, I'm leaving GA. Gonna lay in the hot sun and roll a big fat one, and grab my guitar and play. The 4 days flew by like a drunk Friday night as summer drew to an end. They can't believe that I just couldn't leave, and I bid adieu to my friends. 'Cause my bartender, she's from the islands, her body's been kissed by the sun. And coconut replaces the smell of the bar, and I don't know if it's her or the rum. I got my toes in the water, in the sand, not a worry in the world, a cold beer in my hand. Life is good today. Life is good today. Adios and vaya con Dios. A long way from GA. Yes, and all the muchachas, they call me Big Papa when I throw pesos their way. Adios and vaya con Dios. A long way from GA. Someone do me a favor and pour me some Jaeger, and I'll grab my guitar and play. Adios and vaya con Dios. Going home now to stay. The señoritas don't care when there's no dinero. Yeah, I got no money to stay. Adios and vaya con Dios. Going home now to stay. Just gonna prop up by the lake and put my in a lawn chair, toes in the clay. Not a worry in the world, a PBR on the way. Life is good today. Life is good today.
Take a little cry to come undone. get the ferry out from Runa and wave all our cares goodbye. And we go dancing at the Killy, we go kissing on the strand, take our clothes off in the moonlight, skinny dipping hand in hand. We'll start drinking in the twilight, keep it up until the dawn. Bolt the bars because there's no guards. Take our names and send us home. Will you meet me on Clare Island? Summer stars are in the sky. Get the ferry out from Runa and wave all our cares goodbye. Getting weary of the city, seen so many things have changed. Let's head off for Nora Daly's home, where she walked it never rained.
Hold your anesthesia to show you that you belong, belong.
rescue.